Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm with my good friend Russell Chianelli today. And we have a guest from Canada, originally from Canada. He moved a long way from Canada and he got as far as Michigan. His name is Vernon Carruthers. He's a professor of microbiology and immunology at Michigan University. And Vernon, welcome to Science Studio.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
This is going to be a lot of fun. But before we get into your immunology and your microbiology, and there was a paper you published and I read the paper. I read every word and I didn't understand the whole thing when I'd finished. I'm not going to reproduce that now because we haven't got enough time. But how did you become a scientist? What were those formative years?
When you were
years?
A kid.
Well, I'd say a major influence for me was a high school teacher. His name was Mr. Glenn Grevy, and he was teaching geology and biology, and I had him in my junior and senior year of high school. And he was a fantastic teacher. He would take us out on field trips and really immerse us in these aspects of science. And he was very inspirational for me. From there, I knew that I was interested in both of those subjects, but I chose biology in college just because I felt like there were more health-related applications of working in that particular area.
But when you were a kid and you were out roaming around with him, did you pull up a rock and see an animal that you really liked, a bug or something?
No, we did the usual things. We'd go out and take water out of a pond and peer at it under a microscope and realize there's a whole nother world out there we can't see. And
this was
part
in
of what?
British Columbia.
In British Columbia, yes.
Right. So you went to university in British Columbia?
I did, yes. So I moved from the small town I grew up in northern British Columbia down to go to college at the University of Victoria, which is at the south end of Vancouver Island, just off the coast of British Columbia.
One of my very favorite places in the whole of North America, where you can actually get high tea.
Absolutely, at the Empress Hotel.
And actually, the other thing, when you're looking at the water, you might find some hydrocarbon-degrading organisms because there's all kinds of petroleum spilled around there.
There can be. The Exxon Valdez is a great example. That was quite far north. But
we don't want to go there because we'll never get off the subject if we do.
The reason is that I worked on this. I was the science leader for the bioremediation.
I see. Yes, very good.
So anyway, you get the degree in biology in the end? Or?
Well, I started out in biology, but I also was starting to get more and more interested in potential health-related aspects of biology. And so I switched into biochemistry and microbiology as my major.
Okay. Did you do undergraduate research?
I did, and really quite a stroke of luck to get into this. My parents had moved down to not too far from the University of Victoria to open a small restaurant, and I was resigned for one summer, I think between my sophomore and junior years, to just help them in the restaurant. And then I got a call from one of my classmates who told me that there was this opportunity in a research lab on campus and that I should go and apply for an interview, and I got this opportunity. And this is what really sparked my interest, much deeper interest, because I just was so fascinated by the process of going along and trying to understand something that is unknown, really. Discovering something that is no one else knows is a high that I think every scientist who does research...
We would like to have every science major have that experience, but you know, you have to restrict it to a certain extent. There are programs now which sort of try to bring in research to all the students in the freshman level, but it's difficult to do it at the intensity. What was your research project?
Well, initially it was growing blue-green algae in large vats and isolating particular metal-binding proteins from these, also doing a little bit of work in mice. But then the lab was switching over to working on a parasitic infection, leishmaniasis.
Oh.
The professor I was working with was called to the dark side by a close colleague and friend who worked on African trypanosomes, which are a related disease or infectious agent. And so we started working on leishmania, and it was just amazing to me. They're so neglected, so poorly understood, yet incredibly sophisticated infectious agents.
Right, and becoming more important in the United States. I mean, it was always thought, I thought, that they were sort of down there in the tropics, and they were coming up, but now I gather from some of my colleagues here, Rosa Maldonado or Igor Almeida, that in fact, quite a few people giving blood, for example, in big cities like L.A., are infected with these parasites.
Yes, different forms of them. That's true. Absolutely, yes. They are creeping into the U.S. Travelers also can experience these kinds of infections when they go abroad, too.
So there you are. You've done some interesting work on blue-green algae and metal complexes, wonderful stuff. But Ruth and I love this sort of stuff. But for a PhD, what did you do? And did you do that in Victoria also?
I did not, no. I was interested in potentially pursuing an MD PhD. I wasn't so interested in the clinical aspects, but I felt that having the clinical background would help me frame the questions that I wanted to ask in my career. But I just couldn't find a mentor in that region that I was really excited about their work. And so I instead moved across the country to Ontario, London, Ontario, where the University of Western Ontario, now called Western, and worked with a professor there who was studying African trypanosome. So this is African sleeping sickness now. And I was really fascinated by their ability to change their surface coat so that they can avoid being eliminated by the antibody response.
Yes,
the parasite. Yeah, this is another eukaryotic parasite related to Leishmania, more distantly related. And so I was really fascinated by the structure of the molecule they use and they switch. They have a library of genes that they put out, the products out on the surface, and they keep switching them to keep one step ahead of the immune response, and really interested in how one molecule could have so much diversity and yet still form a really tight packed coat on the surface to protect all of the underlying non-variant proteins. So that's where I got really interested in protein structure and antigens.
Would you call that survival of the fittest, an evolutionary character?
Absolutely. No, they're amazing in how much of their genome is devoted to just avoiding the immune response in this way, this elaborate form of antigenic variation. Yeah, so they're highly adapted to live inside a host and survive, persist inside the host, even though the host has a very highly sophisticated immune response.
These sorts of things can remain, I'm going to say the word, it's probably wrong, but sort of dormant for a long time.
These ones don't, well, not so much this organism.
Okay.
This one actually divides in the blood system, also in the tissue spaces. And it's remarkable because it basically says, bring on the immune response. We can deal with it. It doesn't try to hide from it. It just keeps switching. And basically, it's a master of disguise. It keeps switching so that the immune response can't recognize it. It's a new variant that comes up. And then so this continuous cycle of the parasite growing up and then the immune system trying to control it, and you get these periodic fevers that are spikes in the replication of the parasite in the blood system.
So it's not like sort of mutants forming that are sort of drug resistant. This is all built into it.
Yes, exactly.
So just can switch on this, switch on the other.
So they have
one
major protein forms a coat on the surface, but that protein keeps switching. So they have 1,000 different variants of it that they just keep switching the expression of these sequentially so that they can avoid being eliminated by the immune response. It's really quite remarkable.
Doesn't that make you depressed when you sort of think about how clever these things are?
Yes, maybe depressed, but also inspired by trying to understand how it does this.
Right.
It manages to be so successful, again, in people who have very good ways of controlling most agents.
It reminds me of a story about Lyme's disease, where they were telling you, do not use penicillin on Lyme's disease, or that will make it stored in your body forever. Can
right.
you explain that a little bit, too?
So Borrelia burgdorferi is the cause of Lyme disease, and it's also very good at persisting, so it can go into a very low-level infection. I'm not so familiar with how it avoids being completely eliminated by antibiotics, but Borrelia can sit in different tissues, can get into the joints, and you can get inflammation in these joints as one of the consequences of long-term infection.
So after your PhD, then did you do the obligatory postdoctoral period, or did you go straight to an academic position of your own?
No, I didn't go straight to an academic position. Of course, that's very rare these days. I got an opportunity. A professor from the Rockefeller University was visiting my institution through a collaboration. His name was Professor George Cross. And he invited me to come down and work in his lab as a postdoctoral fellow in New York City. And so that's where we moved next. packed up the U-Haul and drove down, which was a comedy in itself because we'd never been to such a large city. And in fact, driving this large U-Haul, we got on the wrong roads where trucks shouldn't be, and we were getting honked at and all sorts of things. And then the only exit we could really get off to once we realized we were on this road was 42nd Street. And back then, it was a little dodgy. Yeah,
with a U-Haul.
All sorts of interesting clubs along the way there. So that was our introduction to New York City.
And how long did you do the postdoc? Was it the same general area of parasitology?
Switching more into developing genetic tools to manipulate the genome of the parasite and try to do gene knockouts, which weren't established at that time. So that's what our focus was, trying to develop new tools that would allow us to ask questions about how antigenic variation works, for example. And after 4 years there, that went quite well. I was on the job market for a faculty position, but the NIH funding at the time was horrible and no one was hiring. And so it just caused me to kind of rethink what sort of direction to go in. And I was thinking about leaving parasitology altogether and going into something that might be a bit more fundable, like heart disease. But then a chance meeting at a meeting I met with a young investigator named L. David Sibley, who at the time had just started his lab at Washington University, and he was really impressive to talk to. I mean, he was working on this bug that I didn't know much about, Toxoplasma. It was caused an infection called toxoplasmosis that was severely affecting people with HIV/AIDS. At the time, there weren't good medications to control the virus, and so people were dying of all sorts of opportunistic infections, one of the more prominent ones, was toxoplasmosis. And so this felt like a great opportunity because this is an infection that is not restricted to the tropics. It's not restricted to poor countries, rich countries. It's a global infection, and also one that was really affecting people in the United States, and so I felt the funding for it might be a little bit higher priority. It also is a cause of disease in otherwise healthy individuals, too. So even in the absence of this wave of opportunistic infections happening in HIV/AIDS individuals, you know, I felt like there was and it also there were some really nice tools that were being developed.
So is this going to be an opportunistic move?
It would be an opportunistic move. Absolutely. Yes. And, you know, it's a.
So you went to Wash U?
I went to Wash U, that's right, and did effectively a second postdoc, although I was a research faculty at that point. And there, in a new system of which there was very little known, there were all sorts of opportunities. Just about any experiment you did, you learned something new about it. And so that was a really good move in hindsight.
We'll take a short pause. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli and Vernon Carruthers from the University of Michigan. We'll be back in one brief moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. What mother hasn't said these words? Take your shoes off at the door.
It's good advice because new research shows you are bringing in dangerous bacteria if you don't. One of them could be Clostridium difficile.
Known as C. diff, this bacteria commonly resides in soil. It causes significant intestinal disease in humans. They form highly stable forms called spores that resist drying and most disinfectants.
This means C. diff can survive on dry surfaces for up to 90 days, which offers many opportunities for it to transfer onto your hands and into your mouth.
C. diff causes intestinal disease when the normal balance of bacteria in a large intestine is disrupted, for example, by a round of antibiotics to treat something else. This allows C. diff to grow, causing a nasty diarrheal disease.
15,000 Americans die yearly from C. diff infection, in some cases because the bacteria became resistant to antibiotics.
In the new study at the University of Houston, almost 40% of the soles of shoes tested positive for C. diff. One-third of bathroom or toilet samples were also positive, and 33% of dust samples from homes grew C. diff.
Further, almost 20% of other home surfaces yielded positive cultures. Since these bacteria can persist, once they're in the house, they can be picked up by unknowing hands.
Other studies have found everything from Listeria to E. coli on the bottom of shoes. So what's the solution? A regular hand washing is a must, and C. diff spores can be killed by bleach, which my mom always used. Now I just have to learn to take my shoes off at the door.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Vernon Carruthers from the University of Michigan, from the Department of Microbiology and Parasitology and all those other ologies. So we've learned a little bit about your background, and eventually you got your own faculty position. And what did you decide to really concentrate upon with this rather large and sophisticated background?
Right. So one of the things I was very interested in, having worked with a parasite, African trypanosomes, that lives in our extracellular spaces and just deals with the immune response, now we're working with an intracellular organism. It has to enter into our cells, and it uses that as a means of avoiding some aspects of the immune response. So initially, we were very interested in how these bugs entered into our cells. Now, remember, these are eukaryotic
Hang on, parasites. Can I just question that for a minute so I get it clear?
Yeah.
It's an interesting, and I never think about these things. So, you know, an immune response can impact things outside of cells, but doesn't generally get intracellular. Is that what I learned from what you just said?
No, there are different aspects of the immune response that can affect extracellular infectious agents, microbes, and also different wings that will affect intracellulars too. But something that lives inside our cells for most of the time would not be so susceptible to antibodies, for example, which typically work extracellularly. Okay. There are other means by which the immune system can attack intracellular organisms by recognizing the infected cells and trying to kill those infected
So there
cells.
You are. Now you're established. You're a young assistant professor of microbiology, parasitology. What did you immediately jump to do?
Well, again, we were focusing mostly on the entry event initially, but you know, as the way this business goes, along the way, you realize there are other things that are really fascinating and very important to the biology of the infection as well. And so one of the things that this led to was that we discovered some products that the parasite secretes. And when we interrupted the expression of one particular product, the parasites invaded normally, but they couldn't really get out of the cells very well. And this event is known as egress. Of course, they have to break out of the cells if they're going to go infect new cells. And so we started trying to understand how that particular product worked in the last step of its intracellular replication to leave the cell. We also got interested in how the parasite, like any parasite, acquires resources from the host, right? I mean, that's the mark of any good parasite.
Right.
It leeches off of the host, right? And so living inside our cells, it has to acquire nutrients in order to make more of itself. And so we're very interested in how it gets those materials as well. And we've learned that the parasite is actually nibbling little bits of the host cell while it's replicating inside and sending that material into its stomach to digest that material. And then that led us to try to understand why that does that process in the chronic stage of the infection. So like some other infections, it will go through an acute phase, the immune system will control it but not eliminate it, then it goes into a persistent stage. And that stage is in the brain. It's in the eyes, it's in the brain and other tissues. It goes into neurons.
You know, I hate these programs because, you know, I mean, I go outside and I think they're all out there. Right? You know, just in, there's not one part of me that's sort of going to be off limits. You published a paper. Let me just read the title of this. Okay, this is 2016, I believe. Yeah, it was. A Toxoplasma gondii orthologue of Plasmodium gamma contributes to parasite attachment and cell invasion. Now, you know, I understand all the words. Tell us in some simple detail, but that the layperson
for
and
faculty
us and I can
and
understand.
Fans out there that are listening,
what is that
like
all
to
about?
Understand that a little bit better.
This relates back to what I was talking about originally and trying to understand how the parasites enter into cells. And for some time, we were interested in proteins the parasite secretes from secretory granules. So it packages these proteins into little granules at the front end of the parasite, and cleverly, it releases them right when it's going to invade into a cell. And this is where these secretory granules contain proteins that are adhesive, they're sticky. And so they bind to receptors on the target cell and help the parasite grab onto it to pull itself into the target cell. And it makes a variety of these kinds of proteins, some of which are unique to this parasite and others that are shared with related parasites like the malaria parasite. Okay, so it had been previously shown in malaria parasite that one particular protein called gamma that seemed to contribute to entry, but really didn't follow up deeply in terms of how it contributes. So we identified a related protein in toxoplasma, and in the study performed a gene knockout. So we eliminated the gene and therefore eliminated the product itself, and then we assessed how impaired the parasites were for entry. So that work suggests that this protein is one of the adhesive proteins it uses to recognize receptors. And part of what's interesting about that is that malaria and toxoplasma, although they're related, they have quite a different biology. The malaria parasite largely lives in red blood cells inside us, whereas toxoplasma lives inside our nucleated cells. It doesn't live in red blood cells. So I think it's fascinating to think about how these two related organisms evolve to have different target kinds of cells, and how their repertoire of different adhesive proteins have kind of evolved to allow them in that selectivity.
And for our audience out there too, could you list a little bit basically either cures or preventions? I mean, you know, it sounds to me like you could prevent this or you could cure it.
Well, preventions are just trying to minimize the risk factors of acquiring the infection. And they're quite simple. So the way people get this infection is through eating undercooked meat that has the parasite inside it. Mm-hmm. So if you cook your meat well enough, that will reduce it. Might not taste quite as good, but it will reduce your chance of getting the infection.
And then you'll have all those other things that, you know, comes with the charcoal.
Right. That's true. Absolutely.
I mean, it's a no-win operation.
It's a no-win operation. That's right. And the other way people get this infection is by exposure to cats who get infected. So some people know this infection because this is the reason why women who are pregnant should not change the cat litter box, because the woman is at risk of acquiring the infection from a cat if it's infected. The mom is not so at risk of getting severe disease, but the baby is if the infection crosses into the fetus. And so by reducing your exposure to cats, especially during pregnancy, for example, you can minimize your chance of getting it. But we should be clear here and say that roughly 15 or 20% of people in the U.S. are chronically infected with this. They have it in their tissues, they have it in their eyes, in their brain, they don't have severe disease.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of an interesting philosophical point. Parasites live off of their host. They don't want to kill the host.
In most cases, that's correct.
Yeah, and so therefore there could be, what's the percentage you think of people wandering around that have got a parasite that they particularly wouldn't want, but on the other hand, it's not having any sort of big disastrous impact upon their health and their lifestyle?
In the United States, it's relatively low. Toxoplasma would be the most common parasite that people would have here in the U.S. Throughout the world, though, in regions of the world that don't have access to clean water or good health care, people can be heavily infested with a variety of different parasites.
And survive is my point.
They survive, exactly, yes.
And survive sort of reasonably well?
It's true. So if you think about an infectious agent, what it's really its purpose is to replicate long enough inside a host so that it gets transmitted to another host. That's the key.
It needs to be transmitted. This sort of intellectual driving force.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way.
I mean, but an interdisciplinary interaction.
Yes, exactly.
Or colonizing the moon, like we think we want to do.
Right. So some infectious agents, like certain viruses, come in, and they, like the cold virus, they infect us. They have to deal a little bit with our early immune response, but they're just kind of hit-and-run bugs. They're going to go on and infect the next person who touches that doorknob that was had the cold virus on it. Whereas other agents, and parasites fall into this, have a longer-term relationship.
You said doorknob, right?
I did.
My wife is a nurse, and, you know, watching her go into a hotel and get into rooms or hit the elevator buttons is just absolutely amazing to me. You know, there's never touching. It's always some other, you know, there's the hand, but there's something between the hand, or it's the key. There's a reality to that.
There's some reality to that, of course.
You know, it makes me think of something that maybe you've thought of too. Could there be a host-human interaction that actually works to be positive, because the interaction produces something that wipes out something else?
Yes, that wouldn't be a parasitic relationship. That'd be a symbiotic relationship where the host provides a home and the parasite or whatever the entity is gains something from that relationship in terms of having a home, but also provides something in that relationship too.
Well, that's similar to this big what's it, fad nowadays of taking prebiotics or something.
Prebiotics, I mean, that's one example.
Yes.
Right? But worm parasites, so these are now animals, right? They're multicellular. So they can live in different parts of our bodies. Some of them live in the intestinal system. Again, they're not very common here in the U.S., but they are common in other parts where hygiene is not so great. Worm parasites can have somewhat of a beneficial role. They modulate the immune response and actually reduce people's propensity to develop allergies and even asthma, for that matter. And so, you know, there's one theory out there, the hygiene hypothesis, that we're actually too clean in the Western world, right? That we haven't had these kinds of parasitic infections. And so our immune system that was kind of the part of our immune system was designed to try to control those gets out of control.
That's interesting, because that you can make a case here that says, look, we're far too clinically healthy. I mean, you cannot get a regular soap anymore that it doesn't contain some antibiotic material at low level. And so we're too clean. Now, how do you get around that? Maybe you get around that by saying, well, the answer to this is worm therapy. That would sure as heck make people want to go out there and roll around in the dirt a little bit more and get dirty rather than worms.
Well, I'm never
going
to give up my aged meat. I mean, aged meat is a tradition.
Well, in fact, people are using worm therapy in certain situations. You can go on the internet, as I understand it, and order some worms from Europe for a parasitic worm infection that doesn't really, that it will start to develop inside people, but it doesn't fully develop and therefore eventually gets flushed out. And that can help reset the immune response. So, for example, in cases of inflammatory bowel disease, some people are trying to use this kind of a therapy to kind of reset the immune response.
So when the worms have done their number, how do you get rid of the worms?
Well, in this case, it's a worm that normally doesn't infect humans, so it only partially develops, and then they just are expelled.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. So what's your current really hot item, something that you're really excited about?
Yeah, I'm very excited about the parasites' system for bringing in material and digesting that material. What we've discovered is that if you eliminate one of the key digestive enzymes in its stomach, the lysosome of the cell, that the parasites are able to replicate more or less normally during the first phase of the infection. But once they go into the tissues and develop this persistent stage, they can develop that persistent stage, but then they just die. And so what we've got excited about is that this target digestive enzyme is druggable, in air quotes. So we've been working with a medicinal chemist to design inhibitors against this as a possible therapy for the chronic infection. If such a therapy were available, then people who have recurrent ocular problems due to the infection, the recurrent cycle of being in dormant, then flaring up and damaging the retina, and then going dormant and flaring up and damaging, that could be interrupted, and perhaps we can improve the vision in these individuals.
So to sum up then, you've in a sense come full cycle, because you started out thinking of geology, biology, and then you started to sort of throw in the concept of human health, and now you've done all this really fundamental work, and you're coming back to the idea of actually treating people that have got an issue. That's satisfying.
I find that tremendously exciting. I recognize we're not a pharmaceutical company, but we know enough about this infection that we can take it far enough that if it looks promising, that this could be handed off for further development and other people who can take it further.
Vernon Carruthers, University of Michigan, thank you so much for being here. It's been a lot of fun.
And thanks to our producer, Dennis Wu.
And also to Lauren Tarasas, who's actually going to edit the program so we sound like we know what we're talking about. Thank you to the listener. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so stay tuned.